To speak about my spiritual journey. And when I asked Ananda Vrindavaneshwari for more details, she said I could speak about Srila Prabhupada and chanting. So every journey begins with the first step. But when I thought, what is the first step, I could not say, because it probably began before this life. And even if I tried to guess what the first step in my last life was, it probably would have gone back to the life before that. So I will choose a point, more or less arbitrarily, within this life. When, I guess, when I was at the university at Brandeis in Waltham, Massachusetts, I was looking for perfection. And I began as an English major, because I thought, you know, in English I would find the meaning of life. But the English as taught in the university dealt with other matters and not so much about the meaning of life. So I thought I'll become a philosophy major. And I found the same thing. I thought I'd find the meaning of life, but they were discussing other topics. So then I thought, well, let's try psychology. And I was lucky because the psychology department at Brandeis University then was developing what they call a third force in psychology under the chairman, Abraham Maslow. And the other two, one was behaviorism, which was the study of stimulus and response, mainly in rats. And the other was psychoanalysis, which studied diseased persons. So Abraham Maslow had the idea that there should be a third force to study healthy persons. And the psychology department invited many speakers from different Eastern mystical traditions. By reading, I had understood that I needed a guru. I'd read many books, but the final conclusion was I needed a guru. And from then on, my quest was to find my perfect master. And I went to many. I will cite some examples. There was a Zen master who was supposed to have been certified as enlightened by another certified enlightened Zen master from Japan. So I went to his ashram in Rochester, New York, and we had to sit erect, facing the wall, in some sort of meditation. And then the master would go around with a stick. And if he found that you were being inattentive, he would give you a whack with the stick. So I got a little bit discouraged, but I was really looking, so I didn't give up. I didn't give up. I stayed for the weekend and got to know him and the students. And then, coincidentally, you could say, when I went back to Boston, a professor at MIT named Houston Smith arranged a lecture with the same Zen master. And someone in the audience asked about Vedanta. And he replied, don't ask me about Vedanta. I have enough trouble keeping up with Zen. So I thought, he's not my perfect master. Then, at Brandeis, the department invited a famous Hatha yogi, and he gave a lecture. And the part I remember most vividly is he said that by yoga you can gain mastery over your involuntary muscles, specifically your colon, and you can command your colon, I guess, small intestines. I forget the exact name, but ascending colon advance, and then it goes
up.
Transverse colon, advanced, then it goes across. Descending colon, descend. Then it descends, and then rectum, release. And then. So, I was intrigued, I must say, I was intrigued. Because I was so, desperate. I didn't want to discount any possibility. So then I asked, can I ride with the Swami, his ashram was in New York, he was going to the airport. And they said, no, you can't ride with the Swami. His car is already occupied. But you can ride with some of the students. So on the way to the airport, they were discussing all the different types of food they missed since they had joined the ashram. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem right. You know, they just finished a lecture by the Swami, and they're just thinking about the different types of food they were missing. But I thought, anyway, they're just the students. You can't necessarily judge from the students. Let me meet the master. So I went to the airport, and he was the picture of Indian spirituality. He had like long, flowing hair, long, flowing beard, long, flowing robes. And he was very, and not just that, but the twinkle in the eyes, the blissful grin, I mean, everything. And when I got there, he was, I would say, very warmly embracing all of his lady admirers. And I looked and I thought, he's not my perfect master. So there were others, quite a list as a matter of fact. But anyway, then just to accelerate a little, I heard that there was a psychology professor at Antioch College in Ohio who was supposed to be enlightened. So I thought, okay, I'll try again. I mean, I was really desperate. So I drove to Antioch. I waited till classes were over, then Friday I drove and went to his office, met his secretary, and said, I want to meet so and so. She said, he's playing golf. She must have seen the look of incredulity on my face. And she said, that is his Zen. He is not my perfect master. So I driven all the way, so I went to the student union. And the students were talking about another Swami who had just visited the campus. I don't really know his name, but it ended with the syllables Ananda, which isn't of much help in trying to identify that person. I tried later, but there are too many Anandas. But they said that he had said that God is in your heart and you can have a personal relationship with him and he can speak to you. And this captured my attention because up until then, everything I'd heard was impersonal. The idea that God is impersonal, that the ultimate goal of life is to disappear into the void or merge into the one. And I thought, wow, God's a person, he's in my heart, and I can have a relationship with him. So I went back, and I had developed the idea that you don't like choose your guru, but like your guru is there. Not exactly your guru chooses you, but it's somehow that I had a guru, but he hadn't been manifest to me. So, and I had an image of a sort of vague mental impression of him, and he didn't have hair, and all the other swamis had long hair. So after so many, and I was almost hopeless. I'd gone to so many, and every time I raised my hopes, and every time I was disappointed, and I finally became despondent. I can't find my guru. So, I had friends, we were going to go to, I was already a vegetarian by then, so I invited them over to my apartment for soup and pasta and salad, and we were going to go to a movie in Harvard Square. But just that day, I had seen a poster on campus, Bhagavad Gita as it is, Swami A.C. Bhaktivedanta, such and such auditorium, such and such time. And I looked at it, and by then I was so discouraged, I didn't even take it seriously. But after dinner, when it was time to leave, that poster came to mind, and something in my heart was very forcefully telling me I had to go. So I mentioned it to my friends, and they said, well, we already have a program, just to go to an art house and see a Japanese movie. And I said, well, we'll just go to the late show. Some grumbling. But the one who really objected was a lady friend who really got upset. And my nature was to, to please people. I didn't like to upset people. So I kept trying to agree. But then something inside of me kept insisting, you must go, you must go, you must go. And I just couldn't resist that force. And then finally she blurted out, why can't you be like normal people? Why do you have to go running after these swamis all the time? And I blurted out, all right, this will be the last one I ever go to. and it was. So, because of all the discussion, we got late, but there was kirtan. And the auditorium had bare brick walls, and the sound was reverberating. And Prabhupada was on the stage, and the devotees were dancing in a circle around him on the stage. And one by one, students from the audience were getting out of their seats and rushing up the stage and joining the chanting and dancing on the stage. So I stood up, and I felt like that's what I should do. And I looked on that side. Some of the friends were on that side. I looked on the other side and I thought,
this will be too much, and they just won't be able to bear it.
So I sort of was dancing in the aisle in front of the seat. And then, at the end of it, Satsuru, I didn't know any of the names then, but he announced, if anyone has a car and is driving to Harvard Square or Boston, please meet the devotees in the foyer, because they need a ride. So I had a car, and I went out, and the first devotee I ever spoke to was Bharadraj Prabhu, and he was like totally high on Krishna consciousness. I mean, he was just like overflowing. And so yeah, they were all piled in. And in the front seat, there was a lady disciple, Prabhupada's name, Janava. And, you know, I had all these questions, so I asked her, you know, what about Zen? And she said that this world is just like images on a screen, and like a movie screen. And if you draw your consciousness back, there's light. And then when you come to the end of the light, there's a point. It's sort of like that was the void. I thought, wow, that's a better explanation of Zen than I ever heard before. And she said, but behind that point, there's a machine, a bulb and a machine, and there's a person operating the machine. I thought, wow, that was the best explanation, and it goes even beyond. So then I asked about Yogananda, because I had read autobiography of a yogi. And oh, Yogananda, he's just a shopkeeper. You know, you want yoga, he has yoga. You want meditation, he has meditation. You want Shiva, he's got Shiva. You want Ganesh, he's got Ganesh. He's just a shopkeeper. Wow, she's really powerful. And then she said, if you go to his ashram, there's a statue of Mahatma Gandhi that says, worker for world peace. He wasn't a worker for world peace. He was working for India's political independence. He doesn't even know who Mahatma Gandhi is. And I thought, my gosh, she is powerful. But I thought, this power could not be coming from her. She just had to go, you know, 18-year-old, 20-year-old, 22-year-old girl. This power must be coming from someone beyond her. It must be her guru. So then I went to the temple the next night, and Prabhupada was speaking. He had quite a thick accent, and I wasn't used to it, so I couldn't follow a lot of it. But at one stage, he quoted the verse, which I learned later, Manusinam Sahasrasu Kaschajyatati Siddhartha. Out of many thousands of persons, one will see perfection. And I thought, that's me. He's talking about me. So then, you know, the lecture ended, and he asked for questions. And I asked the question that was burning within my heart, that there are so many swamis and yogis and masters, and each one says,
Sweet One advocates a different method of self-realization.
And each one says that this is best. So how do I know which is actually best?
And Srila Prabhupada was so intelligent, he asked me,
what is your goal? Because I would ask him, what's the best means? But the real question is, what is the end that you want to achieve? And then he said, if your goal is to become God, then that means that you're not God now. And how can not God become God? And then he said, God is always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said, Krishna is God. He's always God. He's God when he's playing on the lap of Yashoda. He's God when he's driving the chariot of Arjuna. He's always God. He never has to become God. He said, if you want to serve God, and this was his question, what is your goal? Do you want to become God or do you want to serve God? So then he said, if you want to serve God and you plant the seed of service to God and water it by chanting, God will provide the sunlight and fresh air and all the elements required to make that grow. But if you want to become God, you're only cheating yourself. God is there. He's in your heart. He's ready to help you. But if you want to become God, why should he help the competition? You can become godly, but you cannot become God. And then he said, so what do you think? Do you want to serve God or do you want to become God? Now, at this stage, I had the distinct impression that Srila Prabhupada was looking straight through the walls to the temple, down the roads to my apartment, and he was looking right into my apartment, into my bathroom, to the wall of my bathroom, where I had placed a sign that I had written in my own hand, very ornately with different colors, letters, that read, you are God. I had to put up the sign to remind me in case I forgot. And I just felt he's looking at that sign. He knows everything about me. He's looking at that sign. And he's asking me, so, do you want to serve God or do you want to become God? So by then I understood that the notion of becoming God was not good. In fact, I was overwhelmed with a feeling that this is actually quite abominable, wanting to become God when you're not God. So I said, so, you want to become God or you want to serve God? So I started to say, I want to serve God. But I knew that he knew I couldn't cheat him. So I started, I want to serve God. But actually, I realized I wanted to become God. And he said, yes. So then,
I bowed
my head to the floor in obeisance.
I have found my comfortable spot.
And for years, that was what I remembered. But thinking about it more carefully, in retrospect, I realized that there was another aspect to it, which was that I was afraid to sit up. Because I imagined that everyone in the room would be glaring at me.
Oh, he wanted to become God. He wanted to become God. He wanted to become God.
And I deserved it. That was the truth. But still, I wasn't like, I didn't feel I could face it. So I kept my head down for a long time. Then I heard sounds to indicate that the people were eating. That prasad, I didn't know these words, but prasad was being distributed and people were eating. So I thought, okay, well, this might be a good opportunity. So I sat up and I looked around, and not everyone was looking at me, but the ones who looked at me, like when I sat up, they were all smiling. Oh, wow,
that's nice.
And that was the beginning. So then, life was wonderful at the Boston Temple. And then one day, I mean, there are many stories in between, but one day, the devotees were like in a flurry of activity. I said, what's happening? And they said, Srila Prabhupada is leaving, and they were ready to take him to the airport. So I said, he's leaving? He said, yes, he has other temples, not just in Boston. And from here he's going to Columbus. I said, oh, I didn't know. You want to come to the airport? Yes. So we went to the airport. And those were in the days before 9/11. Everyone could just go out to the gate. There was no security or anything. And I saw that many of the devotees were crying. So I asked one of the lady devotees, Arundhati, why are they crying? So they said, oh, they're feeling separation from Srila Prabhupada because he's leaving. So then I thought, well, this may be the defect. I had not found any defect in Krishna consciousness. I thought, this may be the defect then. The spiritual master has to leave. And then she said that Srila Prabhupada had said that on the absolute platform, meeting and separation are the same. Both are occasions of ecstasy. And I thought, that's a beautiful answer. But I still had some doubt whether it was actually practical. But I heard it. And then the devotees, Prabhupada boarded the plane and the devotees stayed. They didn't go anywhere. So I asked her, why are the devotees staying? And she said that Srila Prabhupada said that when the spiritual master leaves, you should watch the airplane until it disappears in the sky. Just like the gopis watched the chariot when Akura came to take Krishna to Mathura from Vrindavan, they watched until the chariot disappeared in the distance. So I was living in the ashram, and one day we were doing chanting in the streets in front of, I think, the Copy Square subway station. And suddenly, I felt Srila Prabhupada's presence descend on me. And I was like quite overcome with emotion. And I started to weep, and I felt he is present. He is, he's present. And that what he said was true. That on the absolute platform, there's no difference between meeting and separation. Both are occasions of ecstasy. So that was true, but still, Srila Prabhupada was present on the planet in physical form. But from then on, my goal was to bring people to Srila Prabhupada. Even after being in Boston for a year and a half, Srila Prabhupada asked some disciples to come to India, and in India was it the same, even more. Cultivate different important people, but ultimately I just wanted to bring them to Srila Prabhupada. But then when he left physically, I thought, now what will I do? But then I also found that even in his physical separation, one can feel his spiritual presence by serving him, by following his instructions, especially chanting the holy name and serving his mission, reading his books and following his instructions. So his presence is not as immediate as it was then, but his presence is available. And anyone who reads his books and follows his instructions, chants the holy name, serves the devotees, serves his mission, they can feel his presence, and he will reciprocate with their efforts. And that's my conviction, and I'm sure all of you have experienced it to some degree or another, and that's why you're here. So now we have 10 minutes left. Hare Krishna. Yes, so I have been told that you have good questions. I'm ready to answer in a few minutes. I have some questions. There were a lot of messages embedded in this story. And if you don't have any questions for me, I will have some for you. Yes.
Maharaj, and also Mangul Maharaj, this holiness of Pitari Maharaj, made the Avajan, the person who acted in your, did he act in properly, or as you had a thought of?
Well, yes, I did see the Avajan series. I thought he was pretty good. He's probably better than I was in real life, so I have no complaints. I thought he was quite good.
Maharaj, thank you for the very wonderful and absorbing revelation of your coming to Krishna consciousness. It's very exciting to hear. This question, forgive me, it's not directly about that. But it's something I've been wondering for a while, and I'd love to hear your perception. We're urged again and again by Srila Prabhupada in different talks and classes to take a risk for Krishna, which is wonderful. And what I'm thinking is, where do we draw the line when we think about or actually try to take a risk before it becomes gambling, which is a prohibition. Gambling means, I guess reckless, taking a risk.
That's a very good question. We have to be ready to take risks to spread Krishna consciousness. That's true. But Srila Prabhupada also said we should do everything very carefully and cautiously. So if we do decide to take a risk, it should be a calculated risk. And I think of one example of someone or a couple who are in our midst today. I'm referring to His Grace Ravindra Swami Prabhu and his wife. At a certain stage in the history of ISKCON, there was a member of the society who had, I think any large organization, you just get different types of people. And he had been, well, let's say it was alleged that he had had people who opposed him proposed his designs, exterminated. And so Ravindra Swarup Prabhu was sort of called upon to take a stand against him, which was necessary for the protection of the society. But he knew that there could be some risk. And he consulted his wife, because when you're married, you're not alone. You're responsible for your dependents. And, she said, you must do it. And he told a story about destiny. That there was a wealthy merchant who sent his servant into the marketplace in Baghdad to buy some things. And while there, death personified, he ran into death personified. And so he death personified was looking at him in a very menacing way. So he like panicked. And he ran back to his master. And he said, I'm leaving here. I'm going to Samara. So then the master went into the market. And he also saw death personified. And he said, what is that? You jostled my servant? And he looked at him in a very menacing way. what is this? And he said, I wasn't looking at him in a menacing way. I was just surprised to see him in Baghdad, because I have an appointment with him in Samarra in the afternoon. So, Govinda Swarup Prabhu told this story to make the point that some things are beyond our control. You know, I mean, yes, we're in Krishna's hands, and if we see it in that way, that we're in Krishna's hands, then there's no problem. And he quoted a line from a purport of Srila Prabhupada in the second canto about how devotees took risks on Nityananda Prabhu, Haridas Thakur. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that they take risks, that devotees do not mind what comes of the future of their lives, because they are acting under superior orbit, and they take it very seriously. So, I would say, yeah, assess all the risks, all the different factors. Maybe consult others. And then decide. Hare Krishna.
We have lots more questions. But we are already at 2 o'clock. Is that getting any sound here? So we can either stop here and people can individually ask Maharaj maybe for 5 or 10 minutes, or we can go over 5 or 10 minutes if you all want to sit for a few more minutes. Do you want to have a few more questions?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. So I have a gentleman here in the green. Did you want a question? Do you have
two?
Okay, let's have that.
So we'll
turn that down a little bit.
I have a question. You said you studied under Maslow.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask if the path that you chose to take with Prabhupada and Krishna, would you say that you reached your peak experience from that?
You know, I'll tell very briefly. I mean, it's just because she said to speak about Prabhupada chanting, so. There was a program as Prabhupada at one of the universities, and after the talk, there was chanting in a circle. And I was chanting into the circle, and as I was looking at the people in the classroom, and some were students, some were staff, I just felt this sense of love for all of them, something I never felt before. And then that sense of love, it just like it went beyond the walls of the classroom, just west to Massachusetts, the Midwest, the Rockies, the Pacific, Japan, and then filled up the whole universe. And I thought, wow, maybe I'm having a deep experience. So, I think it was, but more than probably the deep experiences of the subjects that he studied, because it had Krishna, the holy name of Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for letting me ask this question. You kind of spoke about it just then, the experience of going test the universe, and you spoke earlier about Prabhupada looking through you and looking right into the womb of your house. And my question is, as a person who experienced being around Prabhupada, can you make the clear delineations between Prabhupada knowing that he was not his body while he had a body, and being able to feel that experience as a self-realized being with a body, and the delineation of him leaving his body, and the Yama Duras and Vishnu Duras, and that whole that delineation between the two?
Srila Prabhupada definitely did not identify with the body, but he used the body in Krishna's service, just like anything. That everything is Krishna's energy, and so everything should be used in Krishna's service. So he used his body and mind in Krishna's service. As far as the events leading up to his leaving his body, he was detached from the body. Although he did try till the end to give us as much Krishna consciousness as he could. There are actually photos of him lying on his bed, so gaunt and emaciated, and the devotees are holding a microphone to the dictaphone right to his mouth. He was dictating translations and purports with perfectly clear consciousness. And then he left his body, surrounded by devotees chanting the holy names. So I think, he just went on to serve Krishna. Jiva va, maro va, and a pure devotee leaves. It doesn't matter whether he's living or dying, because in the present body he'll serve Krishna, and in the next life he'll serve Krishna. It's all the same.
Thank you very much. I know there are more questions, but do you want to go on for a few more minutes? I hate to leave you on the spot. We'll take one more question, okay, and then we'll give it to you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. One thing that I noticed in the talk, you said how it was so important to bring people to Srila Prabhupada. And I remember you actually brought your parents to Srila Prabhupada. And my question is, is Prabhupada still making arrangements that you could address schools?
Well, there's a background to this question. Initially, you framed it. So, the history is that I was in Calcutta, and my parents came really to take me back. And, so my father said to Srila Prabhupada that he was a very wealthy man, and he was a lawyer. So he said to Srila Prabhupada that, that I want to make a trust for my son and put $1 million in it, which was a lot back then. And I want him to come home and sign the papers. And Srila Prabhupada said, yes, you can make the trust and send the papers and he will sign. So then my mother, her mood was different, but I was a pretty thin then, and sort of sick. You know, India, I had jaundice, and it was taking its toll on my health, and my health was always sort of delicate. So she was concerned about my health, and when she, Yeah, so the discussion, yes, right. So, she was saying that she was concerned about my health. And, so Srila Prabhupada had some, he generally, especially in Bengali, they would Rasgulla and Sandesh. And I think to sort of cheer her up, pacify her, so he had his sister, Kishina, who was there, distribute the Sandesh. And he was encouraging my mother. And then he said to her, because in those days people had the idea if you didn't eat meat, you couldn't get enough protein. That was the conception. So he told my mother that these are made of cheese. They're very high in protein. And then he turned to me and said, you must eat 2 dozen rasgulla and sandesh every day. And I'm working on it. I have, if you want to check, there's a bottle right outside. And then, but he could see like there was, they wanted me back. So then he said, well, don't ask me, ask your son. So I said, well, I want to stay with Srila Prabhupada. And then they were very disappointed. And then Prabhupada himself suggested a compromise. And he said that right now, it was October they came. So he said, right now I'm in India. In April I'll be coming to America. So let him be with me now. I'll take personal charge. And then when I come to America, in April, I'll be here with you. So then I said to my father, just see how intelligent Srila Prabhupada is. Because when it's winter in America and it's too cold, he's in India when it's pleasant. And then when it's pleasant in America in the summer and it's too hot in India, he leaves India and goes to America. And my father, he was like getting enlightened by Srila Prabhupada's association. He said, actually, your master is very intelligent. And then Srila Prabhupada said, actually, your son is intelligent because he has understood my strategy. And then my father said, no, actually, you are, to Prabhupada, actually, you are very intelligent. And then Prabhupada said, well, I guess I must be intelligent. Otherwise, how could I attract so many intelligent young men like your son? So it sort of ended like that. And it ended somehow on a positive note. And as we were leaving Prabhupada's room, my father said to me, and in his system of values, these are like the two highest compliments you can pay anyone. He said, I'll say two things about your master. One, he's a brilliant organizer. And two, he really knows how to deal with people. And then, just as a little sequel, so from there I went to Madras. And we didn't have a temple. I was actually the first devotee from this time to go. And so I was just staying at different people's houses. And all those idlis and dosas and chutney and sambar and rice, I started to gain weight. And then we arranged a program for Prabhupada. He came to Madras. And he saw me. And he said, take a picture of yourself and send it to your mother. Yeah, I'd forgotten. Yeah. So, thank you very much.